All they told you was that the zero was the one thing.
All right, so welcome to the new faculty colloquium. And today's speaker will be me. So I'm going to talk about the Birch and Swinnerton Dyer conjectures. By the way, there's one other colloquium this quarter, which will be Nishant talking about his work, differential geometry. Okay, so Birch and Swinnerton Dyer conjecture is a conjecture about elliptic curves. And originally, elliptic curves over Q, so I'll talk about that formulation of the conjecture first. An elliptic curve over Q is a projective non-singular curve of genus 1 with a distinguished rational point. So it's you typically view it as being contained in P2, and the fact that it has genus 1 means that, for example, if you take the, if it's given by a single equation, which it can be given by, then that equation is a cubic equation. So this just means it's defined by a cubic equation. And the fact that it has a distinguished rational point, that it has a point at all, is a crucial thing. So here, E of Q, this is the set of rational points on the genus 1 curve. And this is one point that is there, so you have at least one rational point. There are many, many genus 1 curves that have no rational points at all. Probably generically a genus 1 curve doesn't. And in fact, if you give me an integer n, such as your social security number, then there exists a genus 1 curve, so the smallest degree of an extension of Q, where it has a point, is equal to your social security number. So it can be very complicated in general. But elliptic curves are the ones that have the irrational point. And these can all be given over Q by an equation. This is an affine equation. You take the projective closure of the variety defined by this equation, but by an equation like this. And the non-singularity condition is just the condition that this cubic have distinct roots in when the elliptic curve is given by this equation. So the sort of really amazing thing about elliptic curves is if you take the set of solutions E of Q to this equation along with this point at infinity, this extra point O, in this case is at infinity, this forms a finitely generated abelian group. The way the group works is if you have two points on the genus 1 curve and you draw the line that they determine, you will intersect the curve in exactly one other point where you count multiplicities appropriately. Then you take that one other point and you draw the line between that other point and this distinguished point O, and you'll again have one other point of intersection. That's the sum of the first two points. So it's a way of taking two points and getting a third point. So you get a finitely generated abelian group. In particular, E of Q is isomorphic to Z to the R, or some positive or some non-negative integer R, plus a finite torsion group, which I'll denote by E of Q tor. Here R is called the rank of the elliptic curve. And I'll talk about ranks of elliptic curves a lot. The Birch and Swinnerton Dyer conjecture is a conjecture about the ranks of elliptic curves. The torsion subgroup is there are only 15 possibilities for this group, and they're completely classified by Maser in the 70s. So a basic question already arises. Problem. This is an open problem. Given an algorithm that takes as input an elliptic curve, for example, you give two integers a and b, that would specify an elliptic curve, and outputs either, well, it outputs R, it outputs this group. Or even more simply, it outputs either, yes, the curve has infinitely many points, or no, it doesn't. Give an algorithm to compute R. Or even to decide if E of Q is infinite or not. And if you look at lots and lots of elliptic curves, you'll find that roughly, well, a little bit less than half the time E of Q is finite, and a bit more than half the time in practice E of Q is infinite if you actually look at curves. Conjecturally, about half the time is infinite, half the time is finite, but you have to look at a lot of curves to see that behavior. It tends to be infinite more often than not in practice for small numbers. But there's an open problem. There is an algorithm that everybody believes works, but it's not really an algorithm because you can't prove that it terminates. There is a procedure implemented on a computer by John Kimona, for example, and also in Magma and other places, that takes an elliptic curve as input and it's supposed to compute this, but we don't know whether it will terminate in practice. So, and there's no theorem guaranteeing that it will. I'll get back to that a little bit later. One special case of this problem is the following. So, if you consider a right triangle with rational side lengths, let's call them capital A, capital B, and capital C, and let's let n, which is 1/2 AB, to note the area of that triangle, then you can ask which integer is n, where here you're assuming that a, b, and c are rational numbers, you can ask which integer is n appear as the area of some right triangle like this. That's the congruent number problem, and it's a basic question that's been around for a thousand years or so, to try to decide which integers n appear as the area of a right triangle. So such integers are called congruent numbers. And it turns out, via essentially just some elementary algebra, that you can show that n is a congruent number if and only if the elliptic curve given by y squared equals x cubed minus n squared x, if and only if this has infinitely many rational points. So it's a fairly special curve. There's just a one-parameter family of these curves. And already even here, we don't know how to decide with certainty whether or not one of these curves has infinitely many rational points. So this problem still remains open. However, the Birch-Swearingen-Dyer conjecture, which I will explain to you as part of this talk, if you could prove it, it would resolve this problem. You would then be able to decide whether or not a number is a congruent number. In fact, in a very efficient manner. Any questions? All right, now I'm going to move on to tell you about the Birch-Swearingen-Dyer conjecture with this motivation. So the motivation for the conjecture is one, there's a connection, say, with some old question in number theory, but there are many, many, many other questions of a similar nature that are related to the BSD conjecture. Another motivation is that this is a $1 million prize problem. I don't know if you care about that, but in case you do, I'm going to stay with it. Okay, so here's what we'll do. So choose a model for the elliptic curve of the form y squared plus a1xy plus a3y equals x cubed plus a2x squared plus a4x plus a6. So this is a slightly more general model than the model over here. But you can choose one like this in such a way that, well, there's a notion of a discriminant of this model. So the discriminant is minimal. The discriminant is very closely related to simply the discriminant of this cubic if you change into the cubic form. I won't give the exact definition of the discriminant. But just to be precise, I want to choose such a model for the curve. This is just some Weierstrass equation. So choose it so delta is minimal. And you can always do that over irrational numbers.
Then define LES as follows. It's the product over primes P that don't divide delta of 1 over 1 minus AP times P to the minus S plus P times P to the minus 2S, where here AP is P plus 1 minus the number of points on E over FP. And there's one other factor, times the product over the primes that do divide delta of 1 over 1 minus AP times P to the minus S. So what this is an Euler product. It defines a holomorphic function. There are bounds on the A sub P that allow you to see that this defines a holomorphic function on the subset of the complex numbers that have real part greater than 3 halves. So this, this defines a holomorphic function on the set of complex numbers S with real part of S greater than 3 halves. And that follows from a bound on AP. AP, an absolute value, is less than or equal to 2 root. Well, it's not going to be equal, so it's less than 2 root P.
So is this effectively computable because they're an infinite number?
They're infinitely many. It's not you can hope to try to compute it at a specific number to some precision. And in a few interesting cases, such as when S equals 1, where this isn't defined as I've defined it so far, there are methods that will allow you to compute it exactly. But that's a serious problem, that there's an infinite package of data. What you're doing here is you're taking this isn't, in a sense, like a generating function. It encodes the number of points on your elliptic curve over every finite field, fp. You can also get the number of points over fq from this information. The number of points over fp determines the number over fq for all. Q is a power of p, so for all powers of p, you also get the number of points. Just a little more notation. If you multiply this all out, you get an infinite sum. This is a Dirichlet series, sum n equals 1 to infinity, a n over n to the s. When n is prime, this a sub p is the same as that a sub p. And this equality defines the other a sub n for n composite. But if you just think about what's going on, when p doesn't divide delta, for example, in all cases, this a sub n, a sub p times q, if p and q are distinct primes, is a sub p times a sub q, and so on. So you just get that formally from this equality. So you could define these a sub n directly, but I'll define them by equality of these two. So this just means you multiply everything out. This should look to you somewhat like the definition of the Riemann zeta function, except you have degree 2 factors instead of degree 1 factors. And then with the Riemann zeta function, when you multiply everything out, you get sum 1 over n to the s, as its Dirichlet series. So this defines a holomorphic function, but only on this right half plane.
But is there some analytic continuation of that in general?
Yes. It's a very, very deep theorem that's on my t-shirt.
Okay.
And I'll discuss that right now. It analytically continues to the whole complex plane because of probably the most important theorem, well, not probably, because of the most important theorem about elliptic curves ever. So here it is. This is a theorem that Andrew Wiles mostly proved when he was trying to prove for Maslow's, well, successfully proving for Maslow's theorem. But he worked with Richard Taylor, and what he did was extended to cover all elliptic curves by Bray, Conrad, Fred Diamond, Richard Taylor. This is Brian Conrad, whose brother was here a couple of years ago. So here's the theorem. If E is an elliptic curve over Q, then S sub E of Z, which equals sum N equals 1 to infinity A N E to the 2 pi I Z N is a modular form. And that apparently has nothing to do with analytic continuation of this, except that notice you have the same A sub N appearing here. And also, what does that mean? So I'll tell you two things, what it means to say this is a modular form, and then I'll mention that it does imply analytic continuation for this function to the whole complex plane. So what this means is the following. It means that there's an N, it's an integer. It's divisible by the same primes as delta. It's not too important exactly what it is for the statement, but there's an integer n such that for all matrices gamma equals a, b, c, d in SL2Z with n dividing c, so the lower left entry is divisible by c, their upper triangular modulo n, you have the following. Let's see, we have F of gamma of Z equals 2. Oh, actually, I'm going to state this in the less traditional way. F of gamma of Z d gamma of Z is equal to F of Z dZ. So the differential F of Z dZ is invariant under the action of every element in SL2Z that's upper triangular modulo n. This notation, though, is possibly slightly confusing because there's a dz, and what does that mean? And Bishop Berkeley would get annoyed about the infinitesimals or whatever. But this is completely equivalent to saying that cz plus d to the minus 2 f of az plus b over cz plus d is equal to f of z for every z in the upper half. In the upper half plane. Sorry, this is a function on the upper half plane. So this is for all z in the upper half plane. You have this condition. So these two are completely equivalent. And you could, this looks sort of strange and contrived, but it's at least just very precise. This looks very natural, but maybe consider less precise. So that's what it means for F to be a modular form. It simply satisfies this transformation condition. It has a lot of symmetry. Anytime you take an element of SL2Z with lower left entry divisible by N, somehow you're relating the value of F at somehow the value of F in the entire orbit under the subgroup of a point, they're all related in a very simple way. So that's what it means for F to be a modular form. And that's what it means for an elliptic curve. Well, that's what Wiles and these guys proved. There are some other equivalent formulations of what they proved. There's also a geometric formulation, which is the following. Let me throw in one extra point to H star. Well, actually not one extra, I'll throw in a whole bunch of points, P1 of Q. By this I mean the rational numbers along the real line plus one point at infinity along the imaginary axis. So I'll draw a little picture of this. So H star is, you have one point up here, I'll think of it as being at infinity, and you have all the rational numbers here, and then you have the whole upper half thing. So if you let x naught of n be the quotient of h star by, well, if you take the matrices gamma considered here, that forms a subgroup of SL2Z called gamma 0 of n. So it's a set of all 2 by 2 matrices A, B, C, D in SL2Z I'm just going to rewrite the previous line such that n divides c. So they're upper triangular mod n. That's a subgroup of SLTZ. It acts on the upper half plane via linear fractional transformations. It also acts on the upper half plane union P1 of Q. And this quotient, well, it's the quotient of the upper half plane via the action of a group, but you can give it the structure of a Riemann surface. So a Riemann surface. And you can interpret the points on this Riemann surface as, well, in some amazing way, as pairs in elliptic curve with a cyclic subgroup of order n. There's some moduli theoretic interpretation of the points of this object. But here's another equivalent formulation of modularity of the statement. So equivalently, Weyl's at all prove that there's a surjective map from x0 to n onto E. And they actually do it. There's some worry about, you know, is this defined over the complex numbers? And I've only defined that over the complex numbers or over the rational numbers. Can you give a structure of curve defined over the rational numbers to x not of n? It's a Riemann surface, but it could also be the complex points of a curve defined over the rational numbers. In fact, it is. And in fact, you can make this map be defined over the rational numbers. But it's enough to prove it over the complex numbers for the Riemann surfaces, as Maeser describes in his paper Number Theory as Gadfly, where he calls this a I don't want to say what he called it. But that's an equivalent formulation of modularity, and I'll come back to that in a minute. So the connection with the BSD conjecture, though, is that either of these statements, which are equivalent, imply that this function has an analytic continuation to the whole complex plane. And that implication was known long ago. Hecke proved it in the 30s. So this, in fact, is holomorphic everywhere for every elliptic curve of the Q. So this the argument isn't trivial. There's definitely some work to show that, but it's classical. So it makes sense to consider LES at any point in the complex plane. Before what Wiles and these other guys did, we simply didn't know that. You could write down a random curve, and you might have to work extremely hard to show that it makes sense to analytically continue the L function. So 11 years ago, we just didn't know this.
So
yes, please.
So once you have a copper like this, mm-hmm. The modular form that you're talking about, can that be viewed as a pullback of the invariant differential?
You take the invariant differential, take, there's a canonical design choice of an invariant differential on E, given once you choose this model, and if you pull that back to x naught of n, well, you get a differential on x naught of n, but then that differential will come from a function on the upper half plane. So yes, this modular form f of z defines a differential on x naught of n. That's the condition for it to be a modular form, that it defines a differential on x naught of n. And that differential is up to a scalar multiple, the same as the differential. So it's some scalar multiple of the differential coming from the elliptic curve. Manning has a conjecture that precisely describes the scalar multiple. He says it should be minus 2 pi I.
So the pullback
very important question.
Depend much on the copper you pick, or is there more than one copper? I mean, once you have one of the right level.
If you choose n to be minimal, then the cover is determined up to sine. Yeah. I mean, modulo, you could always, there are lots of maps from E to itself, and you could compose with one of those. So you get rid of all such maps, and then it's determined up to sine. And if there's some elliptic curve between x naught of n and E, then this constant would have to take into account that. But it's called a Manning constant. It's stupid because it's a constant that depends on E. You have one constant for each curve E. Okay, so this makes sense everywhere. It's a holomorphic function on the whole complex plane. That's something that's now known. And now you can make sense of it at s equal to 1, and that's where the Birch and Sorrentin Dyer conjecture comes up. So here's the conjecture. So this is from the early 1960s. And when they made the conjecture, they didn't know that it made sense, so to speak, but at least it makes sense now to consider this. So it says, I'll state two variants. One is a little bit less refined than the other. I'll state the more precise one first. So the order of vanishing at s equal to 1 of LES. Now, that's something that we don't know how to compute. There's an algorithm that works that will tell you either yes or no L of E1 equals 0. They'll tell you whether or not the order of vanishing is greater than 0. But the exact order of vanishing, we do not know how to compute in general. But what is it supposed to be equal to? It's supposed to be equal to R. R being the rank of the curve. So this is the rank of the abelian group of E of Q. So the rank of E of Q. That's the conjecture. That's the million-dollar conjecture, exactly. This is a completely precise formulation with no details omitted of the conjecture that the Clay Math Institute would like you to prove. A consequence of this, so it's another conjecture that's just an easier version of this conjecture, is that L of E1 equals 0 if and only if E of Q is infinite. Since E of Q being infinite is the same as the rank being positive, and L of E1 equals 0 is the same as the order of vanishing being greater than 0. Very simple equivalence. One direction of this is known, and the other direction seems to be extremely difficult, and in fact, an area of extremely active research right now, I think. So what direction is known? That's not colored. Just because a chalk isn't colored doesn't mean it writes in color. Okay, so this direction is known. It's a theorem. There are a lot of people that had some key input to this theorem, but I think the most important person is, or at least the most important input comes from Kleibig. This theorem in this direction incorporates work of Gross, Saguier, Bumfrieger, Costing, Murdy-Murdy, et cetera, also, there's a completely different independent proof of the same statement due to Kato. But if this is infinite, then the L function has to vanish. So these are two completely, they both have the word Euler system in them, but the proofs are really a lot different, or the constructions are a lot different. So there are two proofs. Kleibig's was first. And in the special case when E has complex multiplication, that has lots of extra endomorphisms, then this theorem was proved by Rubin. So Carl Rubin had an influence, since he did that before people did the general case. So this direction's known. What about the other direction? And that's really the big question. Something I think about. So this is an area of very active research. A lot of people are thinking about it, including Mazur, Rubin. A lot of people don't know the answer. Me, I don't know the answer. But there are various ideas that may or may not work. There's one extremely important and really amazing special case, though, which conjecturally should give you this theorem for essentially 100% of curves. So that special case is the following. If it vanishes, we don't know that this is infinite in general. But what if it vanishes at 1, but its derivative doesn't? Then you do know something. You know a lot. In fact, you know this statement. So theorem. again, this is due to Colleen Bacon, but the work of Ghost Agnew plays such an important role. If L of E1 equals 0, but L prime of E1 is not equal to 0, then E of Q has rank 1, exactly as predicted. And the way this construction, the way their theorem is proved, it's a very difficult thing, but again, I just erased this map from x0 of n to e, which you have by the work of Wiles et al. So in fact, this also, everything I've said uses Wiles et al. In order to, I mean, all these theorems require that e is a modular elliptic curve, otherwise you can't apply the theorem. And for example, Colley-Bacon had proved this result about this direction, but his theorem only applied to curves that were known to be modular. It didn't apply to curves that weren't, well, not curves that were known to be modular, but curves that were modular. And he didn't know which curves were modular at the time when he proved it. So he just had a lot of faith. Somebody would do that for him, and that happened.
The
so,
CM ones that Ruby.
Oh, yeah, yeah, so that's okay. Oh, they're in a class of curves known to be modular, yes. Okay, so this is a theorem that, well, the key input is a construction. So what do you have to prove here? One direction is already done, so you don't have anything to prove. But the other direction, L of E1 equals 0, implies E of Q is infinite. What are you showing? You're saying that if a certain analytic function vanishes at a point, then there exist points on a curve. How are you going to get the points on the curve from the fact that an L function vanishes? Maybe you have to somehow construct them. And that's kind of hard. It's somehow easier to show there aren't any points, which is the other direction. If you think about it, I mean, if you consider the converse of the other direction, which is equivalent, I mean, sorry, the contrapositive of the other direction, which is equivalent, then you're showing that there aren't any points. This other direction is the statement that LE1 not equal to 0 implies E of Q finite. So here you use that LE1 is not equal to 0, and you can use that fact to somehow bound E of Q. You don't have to really construct points, at least a priori. The proof does end up going via constructing points, but that's kind of a trick. So what happens here is you're assuming that it vanishes, and you want to construct some points on E. And there's an idea of Birch and Stevens and Huebner. That you can construct points on E using special points on X not of N, special CM points on X not of N. So there's a moduli theoretic interpretation for points on X not of N. You use that moduli theoretic interpretation to construct a bunch of points here. Then you take their image in E, maybe you add them all up in an appropriate way, and you get one little point in E. And the amazing thing is that this one little point, well, there's a notion of height of a point on a curve. If you have a point P on a curve P, so P is given, say, by x, pair x comma y, you can define a notion of a height. It's just essentially the number of digits of the x-coordinate, and you can make it canonical. But they prove that this point has non-zero height, which is equivalent to it being not a torsion point, if and only if you're in this situation. So it's really, really nice. So I'll call this point y. You show that y non-torsion, if and only if L prime E1 is not equal to 0, and L E1 equals 0. So they actually have, there's a bunch of different ways to choose these points. You get a bunch of different points on E, but they essentially all have this property.
That's just giving you rank at least 1.
Yes, you're right. That just gives you the rank as at least 1. Then you use the methods that Colley-Bacon introduced originally to prove this direction, and that gives you rank exactly 1. So what Colley-Bacon does is he uses all the points up here to construct cohomology classes on the elliptic curve, or in the Galois cohomology of the elliptic curve. It makes a whole bunch of cohomology classes. That collection of classes is called an Euler system, has very nice properties, and you can use that collection of classes to show that the rank isn't any bigger than 1. So yes, this shows you that the rank is at least 1, and then you show that it's at most 1 using Colley-Vagan's methods, which he introduced a long time ago. So this is an important case, but in practice there are a lot of curves that aren't covered, namely curves of rank 2. So here's an example of a curve of rank 2. There's a name for every elliptic curve, and this one is called 389A. It's given by the equation y squared plus y equals x cubed plus x squared minus 2x. And it has rank. It has the property that the order vanishing at s equal to 1 of LES is equal to 2. And in fact, for this particular curve, you can simply look and you find the two independent points one comma zero and minus 1, 1. So these are two independent points on the elliptic curve. They generate the group, so in fact does have rank 2. Well, this shows you that the rank is at least 2, but you can show that it's not any bigger also. But the implication that this equals 2 implies that E has rank 2 is something that you don't know without doing an actual calculation on the curve. And in general, we don't know it. An amusing thing is the following. So you might think via some minimalist principle that most elliptic curves will have rank either 0 or 1. And there are really good reasons to believe this. There are good heuristics for why this should be true. If you actually look at curves, like look at the first, 150 million elliptic curves, as Mark Watkins and I did, you discover that about 20% of them have rank 2. So a much, much bigger chunk than expected have rank 2. And the graph of the proportion of rank 2 sort of looks like it's going up asymptotically to some limit instead of going down to 0, which is what it should be doing. But we all have faith that if you were to draw the graph far enough, it would go back down to 0.
Are you guys looking at the analytic rank or the algebraic rank?
We're looking at the analytic rank.
The analytic rank.
Yes. But even then, even more so, you should expect that to be 0. Of course, they're the same, but or at least they should be the same. Though we take the ones of rank 2, analytic rank 2, and then we get very excited and try to show that they really have points on them. Notice the points are very small. It's actually, when the curve has rank bigger than 1, very often the points are small, and you can find them pretty quickly just by looking. They're not always, of course. What? Rank 3?
Yeah.
There also appears to be a big chunk of rank 3, like a positive proportion. It's ridiculous. I mean, it's not true, but that's in the data. For curves up to conductor 100 million, there's a huge chunk of curves of rank 3, too. Not 20%, but still a sort of visible positive proportion. But again, we think it should go down to 0.
Why are you sure that it should go down to 0?
Because that's what random matrix theory heuristics predict. Basically, what you get is you get a function that looks like, let's see, what is it exactly? I think it's, if this is right. I think that this is somehow the proportion, up to some constant, this is the proportion of curves of rank 2 or bigger, and then and this is all of the curves. So this is just a little, it's just small enough that that the limit will go to 0. So, but there are random matrix theory heuristics do predict that the rank should go to 0. So it's just the heuristics predicted. Also, when we looked at prime conductor curves up to conductor 10 to the 10th, and then it starts looking like it's going down a little bit. So,
are these predictions somehow confirmed if you go from Q to FQ of T when we know more about these elliptic curves?
Nobody's done any experiments there, and there are a lot of curves of large rank there, but as far as I know, I don't know if anybody's done any distribution experiments like this. So there are a lot of curves of rank 2. A big, big question that I care about a lot is proving this direction. If you could prove this direction just for CM elliptic curves of the form, so just for the curves y squared equals x cubed minus n squared x, you would solve the congruent number problem once and for all. But this direction is not known even for those curves. So that problem's still open. Now I want to step back a little bit in time and motivate why heuristically there should be some connection between this function at 1 and the rank. As I've described it, it doesn't seem to be any relation at all. It's just like, well, you know, let's choose some random point, hey, 1, and then see what happens. One reason that 1 is a good choice is that there's a functional equation. If you let, I won't remember the exact factors with 100% certainty, so I'll just write some function here with s and l es. You add in some gamma factors, and these are just some simple functions in the gamma function. And then this will satisfy the equation lambda of s equals epsilon times lambda 2 minus s, where here epsilon is either 1 or minus 1. So there's a symmetry for this L function, at least if you throw in a couple of extra factors. And that symmetry is about the line s equal to 1. So you might think that at the very center of symmetry, something interesting might happen. It's a little different, though, than with, say, a class number formula, where the interesting point is at the edge of this strip where you have some symmetry. But just to draw the picture, you have s equal to 2. And then right in the middle here, this is the center of some symmetry. Over here, the L function just doesn't have that interesting behavior. But here it does, and or at least it appears to. Now, here's the heuristic reason why you might expect something interesting to happen at 1. So recall the definition of LES. I'm just going to substitute 1 into that definition. Whether p does not divide delta, 1 over 1 minus ap, p to the minus 1 now, plus p times p to the minus 2. It used to be minus s and minus 2s. I just replaced s by 1. And then there are the other factors at the primes of that divide delta, 1 over 1 minus ap times p inverse. And here, recall that ap was, by definition, p plus 1 minus the number of points on the elliptic curve over fp, which means that you take the curve given by a nice equation like this, you reduce it modulo p, and then you count up all the solutions. And you do that even if the curve has singular reduction. You can still count up the number of solutions. So that's what ap is. So now if you, remember, this Euler product only converged for real part of s greater than 3/2. So it doesn't make sense to substitute 1 in here. Let's just do it anyways and put quotes here so that we don't get in trouble. Now take this and multiply the top and bottom of each factor by p. Then you get product, or p not dividing delta, p divided by p minus ap plus, this is p inverse, so that's plus 1. And the other factor is not too important, but p over p minus ap. And now this first factor, that's p plus 1 minus ap, which is just equal to the number of points on E over fp. This whole thing is product of p divided by the number of points on E over fp times this finite number of factors right here, which I'll ignore. Now, if your curve had large rank, it would have lots and lots of points over the rational numbers. That's the definition of large rank. You have all these points on your curve. For example, here's one and here's one. Actually, let's think about these two. You have all these points, all two of them. And all the multiples of those points. So you have really a ton of points here. And for each prime p, you consider this group e of f2, e of f3, e of f5. I mentioned before that ap is, so this bound ap is less than 2 root p. This is a bound of process, and this can be rewritten as p plus 1 minus the number of points is less than or equal to 2 root p. So for any elliptic curve at all, the number of points is pretty close to p with some error, but it's really pretty close to p. But if you have lots of points here, you can take this whole package of points, and you have a reason to have a lot of points over each finite field. You take all these points and simply reduce them. So you have these, this huge group that's covering every single one of the curves over each of these finite fields. And because of that, you'd think maybe it would drive up the number of points over each of the finite fields, make them a little bit bigger than they might be, you know, if there wasn't anything happening. And over here in this product, if these are a little bit bigger than p, then this is going to go to zero. So it's just a heuristic, and it's the original motivation for this conjecture. It does turn out, by the way, that if this product converges, Goldfell proved that when you substitute 1 in and compute it, you don't get L of U1. You get something slightly different. And it's off by like a square root of 2. And Keith Conrad, who is here, wrote up some really nice stuff about analogs of the statement I just made. I think that came up when he was teaching calculus or something. So we have some product that converges to something slightly different than expected. So if that's something that interests you, ask Keith, because he wrote some really nice stuff about this. And gave some talks about it. Okay, so that's not what I wanted to tell you. All right, the last thing I want to tell you is about a more refined version of this conjecture, which will look somewhat like the analytic class number formula in algebraic number theory. But before I do that, any questions, comments, or ideas?
The equality of the ranks,
yes,
idea, that came from where? I mean, what's the...
I don't have a good answer to that.
Yeah, I mean, so you have such an equality of ranks for classical L functions, mm-hmm. And those are associated to a scheme, to GM. Mm-hmm. So the order of vanishing is equal to the number of rational points of GM, which corresponds to the rank of the unit group. So okay. I'm wondering if that went into what Pearson's...
I'm sure it did. Yeah, sure it did. And thank you very much for your comment.
What happens if you're interested in ranks over extensions of Q?
There's a conjecture there. Everything's pretty much the same. You just have to define the L function. The big problem, though, is we don't know modularity of elliptic curves over, or even what it should mean over number of fields. So you don't know that the L function makes any sense at 1 in general. That's really the big problem. That's a huge problem. But you can make the conjecture. You just make, in the conjecture, you assert that the L function analytically continues to the whole complex plane, then you make this conjecture. Otherwise, it's the same. And also, there's also a conjecture for abelian varieties over number fields, or abelian varieties over function fields that Tate made, which is, it's still called the Birch-Swearton-Dyer conjecture. I asked him about that, because I started calling it the Birch-Swearton-Dyer-Tate conjecture, because he sort of did a lot of work to generalize it. He said that he didn't really do anything, and that he just made what they did more functorial, so, in the natural way.
But he always says that.
Yeah, he always says that. So. Typical humble Tate. The more humble Tate is about what he does, the more things get named up. So, any other comments or questions? Yes, please.
Could you say a little more about the congruent number problem, how that's solved by the BSD conjecture?
Well, sure. If you know the BSD conjecture, then you know this statement. And it's a fact that you can decide whether or not L of U1 equals 0. I'm not going to say much more about that, but maybe I'll say a little. So I've actually just decided to skip giving the very last part of my talk in order to answer a few questions, and I'll answer yours. But the last part of my talk would have been the following. If you look at LRE1 over R factorial, there's a formula for what this is equal to, and it involves a whole bunch of invariants of the elliptic curve. It's kind of like a class number formula, and I'm not going to describe that. So equals formula. So now I'm done with the official part of my talk, and I'll answer your question. So the connection between how BSD would solve the congruent number problem is that if you knew BSD, then you can decide whether y squared equals x cubed minus n squared x has infinitely many points. And that statement is just completely equivalent to... a congruent number problem. So do you want me to say more about this implication or about the equivalence of this to the congruent number problem.
Well, for example, could you then say what the density of congruent numbers is based on that, or what, you know, could specific information about which m's work? Or is it
you could make statements,
case by case basis?
The problem is we don't understand. It would be a little of both. So you can make heuristic guesses about the density of congruent numbers, because there are heuristic guesses about how often this is infinite,
or equivalently, like one half.
Yeah, rough. I mean, that's the conjecture of Goldfeld, actually. So you can make guesses like that, but there wouldn't necessarily be theorems yet. But at least you'd have, you know, one more is proved about elliptic curves, you'd immediately get something about congruent numbers. One quick thing is deciding whether or not L of E1 equals 0. Let me call this curve E sub n. Deciding whether or not this equals 0. In the particular case of the congruent number problem, there's a theta series, a modular form attached to a quadratic form. And its coefficients tell you whether or not its coefficient at n is 0 tells you whether or not this is equal to 0. So you just have to compute the coefficients of a theta series to decide whether or not this is 0. And there's a simple combinatorial way to decide whether or not certain coefficients of this theta series are 0. And that's described beautifully in great detail in a book of Neil Kollitz on elliptic curves. So I think I'm going to stop there unless there are any further questions or comments. But really, my research is about computing with everything I've mentioned so far, and thinking about the difficult direction of the BSD conjecture, and also worrying about proving this exact formula in many explicit cases. So thank you very much. Oh, yes, please, Adrian.
Yeah, can you tell us about the status of the conjecture? Is it proved for some curves?
It's proved for when the order of vanishing is 0. Wait, which conjecture? You mean the formula or this part that I stated up here?
Either one.
OK, the formula isn't really proved for any general class of curves except for some very specific classes of CM curves with low rank, with rank 0 and maybe 1. So this formula isn't known for a single curve of rank 2, not even one curve of rank 2. This formula isn't known. This statement isn't known for a single curve of rank 4, not even one curve. But if the order of vanishing of this is 0 or 1, this is known. That's really the big theorem. The formula, there are some cases where you know it, you know a lot about it, but it's really up in the air still as far as actually proving it.
But it is known for these CM elliptic curves
for certain,
zero,
certain
with CM by something class number 1. Right?
But that's, I don't know if it's for all of them. I don't think so, actually.
That's Rubin plus his student. Rubin didn't actually do it.
I don't think quite the statement you're making is true, but something along those lines is true. I don't think every single class number on CM rank 0 curve. I don't think it's known for everyone. A lot, though. A huge amount is known towards it, though. Yeah, I mean, there's some subtle issues at 2, for example, for certain CM or for certain CM J invariants. But there's a lot known in the case of rank 0 CM. But rank 2 CM, which happens, I don't know. I mean, again, this formula isn't known for one single curve of rank 2. So the status is when the analytic rank is 0 or 1, you're in pretty good shape. Not exactly, the formula isn't exactly known, but you know a lot towards it, and the rank is what it should be. If the rank is 0 or 1, you don't really know anything. It's only when you have the analytic rank is small that you know a lot. And a big problem is we don't know how to compute this in general. If we don't have a single example where you can prove this is equal to 4, or 5, or 6, or anything above 3. And proving that this is 3 in a given example is extremely deep.
So how convincing is the numerical evidence?
Extremely. All evidence is extremely convincing that this is true, and I have no doubt it's true. So if I were a physicist, it would be true.
Is there a conjecture at upper bound for R?
No, in fact, it's conjectured to be arbitrarily large. But the largest R ever observed was 24. Observed by the National Security Agency in 1999.
The numerical evidence, is that almost exclusively over Q? Or is it also over number fields?
The numerical evidence I know about is over Q and over function fields. There's a function field analog of everything that's almost proved. And there's evidence there that's very strong. And over Q, there's a lot of evidence. I don't know much over number fields. And you know, you have a big problem just making sense of the L function at 1 over a number field. OK, so I feel like I'm running over, so I don't want to. any other questions or comments, you can sort of ask them. But thank you very much for coming. So you can thank the speaker again. Just kidding. Right. So. Yeah. Okay. We should make a meeting to talk about something else. What about, are you going to the cloakroom today? Okay, then we can go to the weekend. I don't think
I'm going to the number
one. Yeah. I'm going to keep making it harder than what you're talking about. You keep telling me it's going to be harder than what you're talking about. It. You can say it's going to get more and more technical. So the only person that understands is Rob Miller there is talking about US solid theory. Were these all functions at first?
These all functions are fine. Piatic all functions. When they start talking about piatic interpolation, I'm just like, okay.
We should have a similar.